This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Here's Johnny!
Author Stephen King has written more than 50 worldwide bestsellers. More than 80 feature and television film adaptations have extended his reach far beyond the bestsellers list, earning him the title of Master of Horror and establishing him as one of the most influential writers of our age.
What's going on?
It's death.
Something in the mist! Shut the doors! Shut the doors!
Ujo, what are you growling at?
I, Georgie, am Pennywise the Dancing Clown. You are Georgie. So now we know each other.
On your feet. Come on, Toot. You prayed enough for one day.
To my feet. Walking a mile, walking a mile, walking a mile, walking a green mile.
Stephen King's newest novel is 11-22-63. The book follows a teacher who travels through a mysterious portal into the past to try and prevent the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The New York Times calls the book a mixture of the ordinary and supernatural. The novel takes readers through a rabbit hole into the diabolical and grotesque stirrings below the surface of America's pastoral landscape and portrays Dallas in the early 1960s as a rapacious and sharply divided place. King's great talent is to keep you reading. His books suck readers from their everyday lives and dangle them over the dark, unexplored abysses of the mind while exploring strikingly contemporary and all too human themes. We discovered King to be a man of tremendous warmth and humor. I spoke to him in front of a sold-out audience at the Portsmouth Music Hall for the Writers on a New England Stage series. First, he read from his then-new book, Under the Dome. King reads and writes in the frank language of a small New England manufacturing town, which may offend some listeners. The story begins on a bright autumn day when Chester's Mill, Maine, is surrounded by a mysterious dome that seals residents off from the rest of the world. Nothing penetrates it. Not prayers, bullets, nor cruise missiles. Inside, a countrified despot-in-waiting is suspending the Constitution and taking advantage of the terror to consolidate his power. At 1,100-plus pages, it is one of the sprawling social dramas for which King is known.
I'm going to read a section that I've never read before. It's going to be a challenge because it's full of profanity, and I'm aware that there are a lot of high school kids in the audience who've never heard any profanity. So I want to be very careful of their tender ears. And all I can say as far as the profanity goes is I'm really glad that I watched Battlestar Galactica because that thing fracking comes in really handy. Usually when you do a reading, you precede it by explaining what the book is about. But the title of the book is Under the Dome. And that's really what it's all about. I worked on it for about 2 years, showed it to my sister-in-law, and the manuscript was like this. She said, "What's it about?" And I said, "It's about a town that's under a dome." She says, "Oh, like the Simpsons movie." And I go, I'd never seen it. You can't hit all of them all the time. In any case, at this point, this town has been cut off by this invisible dome for a couple of days, and Big Jim Rennie, who's tightening his grip on the town, has closed the local supermarket in hopes that he can provoke some sort of civil act of lawlessness, mob violence or something, so that he can tighten down the law enforcement. And boy, he gets what he wants. It's in the first person. There are a lot of characters in here, and believe me, that doesn't matter because you've all been through small towns, and all these people are from every small town that you've ever known and I've ever known, in New England or anywhere in the United States or in the world, I suppose. So here we go. So let's see how this works. Before Officer Thibodeau can really study the crowd, Alden Dinsmore gets into his personal space. Alden looks haggard, seems to have lost 20 pounds since the death of his son. He's wearing a black mourning band on his left arm and seems dazed. "Need to go in, son. My wife sent me to stock up on the canned." Alden doesn't say the canned what, probably the canned everything. Or maybe he just got thinking about the empty bed upstairs, the one that will never be filled again, and the Foo Fighters poster that will never be looked at again, and the model airplane on the desk that will never be finished and clean forgot. Sorry, Mr. Dimmesdale, Carter says, you can't do that. It's Dinsmore, Alden says in a dazed voice. He starts toward the doors. They are locked. No way he can get in, but Carter still gives the farmer a good hearty shove backward. For the first time, Carter has some sympathy for the teachers who used to send him to detention back in high school. It is irritating not to be minded. Also, it's hot, and his shoulder aches in spite of the two Percocet his mom gave him. 75 degrees at 9 a.m. is rare in October, and the faded blue color of the sky says it will be hotter by noon, hotter still by 3 p.m. Alden stumbles backward into Gina Buffalino, and they both would have fallen if not for Petra Searles, no lightweight she, steadying them. Alden doesn't look angry, only puzzled. My wife sent me for the canned, he explains to Petra. A mutter comes from the gathering people. It's not an angry sound, not quite yet. They came for groceries, and the groceries are there, but the door is locked. Now a man has been shoved by a high school dropout who was a car mechanic last week. Gina is looking at Carter, Mel, and Frank DeLesseps with widening eyes. She points. Those are the guys that raped her, she tells her friend Harriet without lowering her voice. Those are the guys that raped Samantha Bushy. The smile disappears from Mel's face. The urge to laugh has left him. Shut up, he says. At the back of the crowd, Ricky and Randall Killian have arrived in a Chevrolet Canyon pick-em-up. Sam Verdreau is not far behind, walking, of course. Sam lost his license to drive for good in 07. Gina takes a step backward, staring at Mel with wide eyes. Beside her, Alden Dinsmore hulks like a farmer robot with a dead battery. You guys are supposed to be the police? Hello? That rape stuff was nothing but a whore lie, Frank says, and you better quit yelling about it before you get arrested for disturbing the peace. Frackin' right, Georgia says. She has moved a little closer to Carter. He ignores her. He is surveying the crowd. And that's what it is now. If 50 people make a crowd, then this is one. More coming, too. Carter wishes he had his gun. He doesn't like the hostility he's seeing. Velma Winter, who runs Brownies, arrives with Tommy and Willow Anderson. Velma is a big, burly woman who combs her hair like Bobby Darin and looks like she could be the warrior queen of Dyke Nation. But she has buried two husbands, and the story you can hear at the bullshit table in Sweetbriar is that she screwed them both to death and is looking for number three at Dippers on Wednesdays. That's country karaoke night and draws an older crowd. Now she plants herself in front of Carter, hands on her meaty hips. Closed, huh? She says in a businesslike voice. Let's see your paperwork. Carter is confused, and being confused makes him angry. Back off. I don't need no paperwork. The chief sent us down here. The selectman ordered it. It's going to be a food depot. Rationing? That what you mean? She snorts. Not in my town. She shoves between Mel and Frank and starts hammering on the door. Open up! Open up in there! Nobody home, Frank says. You might as well quit it. But Ernie Calvert hasn't left. He comes down the pasta flour and sugar aisle. Velma sees him and starts hammering louder. Open up, Ernie! Open up! Open up, voices from the crowd agree. Frank looks at Mel and nods. Together they grab Velma and muscle her 200 pounds away from the door. Georgia Rue has turned and is waving Ernie back. Ernie doesn't go. Numb thud just stands there. Open up, Velma bawls. Open up, open up. Tommy and Willow join her. So does Bill Wicker, the postman. So does Lissa Jameson, her face shining. All her life, she has hoped to be part of a spontaneous demonstration. And here's her chance. She raises a clenched fist and begins to shake it in time. Two small shakes on open and a big one on up. Others imitate her. Open up becomes open up, open up, open up. Now they are all shaking their fists in that 2+1 rhythm. Maybe 70 people, maybe 80, and more arriving all the time. The thin blue line in front of the market looks thinner than ever. The four younger cops look toward Freddie Denton for ideas, but Freddie has no ideas. He does, however, have a gun. You better fire it into the air pretty soon, Baldy, Carter thinks, or these people are going to run us down. Two more cops, Rupe Libby and Toby Whalen, drive down Main Street from the PD, where they've been drinking coffee and watching CNN. They blow past Julia Shumway, who's jogging along with a camera slung over her shoulder. Jackie Weddington and Henry Morrison also start toward the supermarket, but then the walkie-talkie on Henry's belt crackles. It's Chief Randolph saying Henry and Jackie should hold their station at the gas and grocery. But we hear, Henry begins, those are your orders, Randolph says, not adding that they are orders he is just passing on from Jim Rennie. Open up, open up, open up, the crowd shaking fisted power salutes in the warm air. Still scared, but excited too, getting into it. The chef would have looked at them and seen a bunch of Tyro tweakers needing only a Grateful Dead tune on the soundtrack to make the picture complete. The Killian Boys and Sam Verdreau are working their way through the crowd. They chant, not as protective coloration, but because that crowd molting into mob vibe is just too strong to resist. But they don't bother shaking their fists. They have work to do. No one pays them any particular mind. Later, only a few people will remember seeing them at all. Nurse Ginny Tomlinson is also working her way through the crowd. She has come to tell the girls they are needed at Kathy Russell Hospital. There are new patients, one a serious case. That would be Wanda Crumley from Eastchester. Girls, she said, we need you at the hospital. They're the ones, Mrs. Tomlinson, Gina shouts. She has to shout to be heard over the chanting crowd. She's pointing at the cops and beginning to cry, partly from fear, from tiredness, mostly from outrage. Those are the ones that raped her. This time, Ginny looks beyond the uniforms and realizes Gina's right. Ginny Tomlinson isn't afflicted with Piper Libby's admittedly vile temper, but she has a temper, and there's an aggravating factor at work here. Unlike Piper, Ginny saw the bushy girl with her pants off, saw what they had done, huge bruises on her thighs that couldn't be seen until the blood was washed off. Ginny forgets about the girls being needed at the hospital. She forgets about getting them out of a dangerous and volatile situation. She even forgets about Wanda Crumley's heart attack. She strides forward, elbowing someone out of her way. It happens to be Bruce Yardley, the cashier cum bag boy, who is shaking his fist like everyone else, and approaches Mel and Frank. They are both studying the ever more hostile crowd, and they don't see her coming. Ginny raises both hands, looking for a moment like the bad guy surrendering to the sheriff in a Western. Then she brings both hands down and slaps both men at the same time. You bastards, she shouts. How could you? How could you be so cowardly, so cat dirt mean? You'll go to jail for this, all of you. Mel doesn't think, just reacts. He punches her in the center of her face, breaking her glasses and her nose. She goes stumbling backwards, bleeding, crying out. Her old-fashioned RN cap, shocked free of the bobby pins holding it, tumbles from her head. Bruce Yardley, the young cashier, tries to grab her and misses. Ginny hits a line of shopping carts. They go rolling like a little train. She drops to her hands and knees, crying in pain and shock. Bright drops of blood from her nose, not just broken, but shattered, begin falling on the big RK of no parking zone. The crowd goes temporarily silent, shocked, as Gina and Harriet rush to where Ginny crouches. Then Lissa Jameson's voice, a pure and perfect soprano, you pig bastards. That's when the chunk of rock flies. The first rock thrower may never be identified. It may be the only crime sloppy Sam Verdreau ever got away with. One thing, Junior had said as he dropped sloppy Sam off. It wasn't Junior's one more thing, but Junior did not tell Sam this any more than Chief Randolph had told Weddington and Morrison, who had ordered them to stay on station. Wouldn't have been politic. Aim for the chick. That was Junior's final word to Sloppy Sam before leaving him. She deserves it, so don't miss. As Gina and Harriet, in their white uniforms, kneel beside the sobbing, bleeding RN on her hands and knees, and while everyone else's attention is there too, Sam winds up just as he did on that long ago day in 1970 when the team won the state championship and lets fly. He throws his first strike in over 40 years. In more ways than one, the 20-ounce chunk of quartz-shot granite strikes Georgia Rue dead in the mouth, shattering her jaw in five places and all but four of her teeth. She goes reeling back against the plate glass window, her jaw sagging grotesquely almost to her chest, her yawning mouth pouring blood. An instant later, two more rocks fly, one from Ricky Killian, one from Randall. Ricky's connects with the back of Bill Allnut's head and knocks the janitor to the pavement, not far from Jenny Tomlinson. Shoot, Ricky thinks. I was supposed to hit a frackin' cop. Not only were those his orders, it's sort of what he always wanted to do. Randall's aim is better. He nails Mel Searle square in the forehead. Mel goes down like a bag of mail. There is a pause, a moment of indrawn breath. Think of a car teetering on two wheels, deciding whether or not to go over. See Rose Twitchell looking around, bewildered and frightened, not sure what's happening, let alone what to do about it. See Anson Wheeler put his arm around her waist. Listen to Georgia Rue howl through her hanging mouth, her cries weirdly like the sound the wind makes slipping across the wax string of a tin can moose blower. Blood pours over her lacerated tongue as she hollers. See the reinforcements, Toby Whalen and Rupert Libby. He's Piper's cousin, though. She sure don't brag on the connection. They are first to arrive on the scene. They survey it and then hang back. Next comes Linda Everett. She's on foot with another part-time cop, Marty Arsenault, puffing along in her wake. She starts to push through the crowd, but Marty, who didn't even put on his uniform this morning, grabs her by the shoulder. Linda almost breaks away from him, and then she thinks of her little daughters. Ashamed of her cowardice, she allows Marty to lead her over to where Roop and Toby are watching developments. Of these four, only Roop is wearing a gun this morning, and would he shoot? Balls he would. He can see his own wife in that crowd, holding hands with her mother. The mother-in-law, Roop, wouldn't mind shooting. See Julia arrive just behind Linda and Marty, gasping for breath, but already grabbing her camera, dropping the lens cap in her hurry to start shooting. See Frank DeLesseps kneel down beside Mel just in time to avoid another rock, which whizzes over his head and shatters a hole in one of the supermarket doors. Then someone yells, "Who will never be known? Not even the sex of the shouter will ever be agreed on. Get them!" And someone else bellows, "Groceries!" And the riot is on. Thank you. Thank you very much.
That's writer Stephen King reading from Under the Dome for Writers on a New England Stage. King often writes about the danger hidden beneath the surface of everyday life. In 1999, while out walking on a rural main road, he was struck by a van and almost killed. He wrote about that event in his memoir, On Writing, a book which shed new light on King as an authoritative voice in American letters. In the book, he describes lying in a ditch while the driver who hit him, Brian Smith, sits on a nearby rock. Smith later told an investigator that he and his dog left the campground where they were staying because, quote, he wanted some of those Mars's bars they have up to the store. King writes, "When I hear this detail some weeks later, it occurs to me that I have nearly been killed by a character out of one of my own novels. It's almost funny." I talked with King about other intersections between his life and his art and began by welcoming him to the music hall where, uncannily enough, the audience sat under the neoclassical domed ceiling of the theater. Well, Stephen King, what a pleasure on an almost full moon night to be talking with you.
Me too, thanks.
As it would be any night. We have loads and loads of questions from the audience, so I'm going to try and get to as many as possible. But first, the idea for Under the Dome had been percolating for some time with you. You told a group at the Library of Congress last year that you'd been working on it for about 25 years, but you were too young. You just had to put it down, walk away from it. What made you pick it back up in 2007?
I was on a long trip. I was headed for Australia, and anybody who's ever gone to Australia knows that that's a 3 full-feature movie ride. And you're just there. You can't really do anything except think about the fact that you're 38,000 feet in the air, and if the plane goes down, you will probably die. And so you try to think of other things. And my mind went back to Under the Dome. And here's the thing. I had this idea around 1976 or 1977, and it started with an image of these people who were starving and out of resources, choking on their own pollution, giving a press conference, and the people on the other side were in great shape, and this was going out to the whole world, and the world was seeing this town die in their own effluent on TV. Because there was a barrier, but you couldn't actually see the barrier. And I thought it was a terrific idea, and I tried to do it. I got about 75 pages in, was kind of daunted by the cast of characters, but even more so by all the technological questions and meteorological questions. Tried again about 2 years later while I was on the set of a movie called Creepshow that I wrote. And that didn't work either. It was called The Cannibals. You know where that one was going. And good gravy, good meat, good God, let's eat. So, but the thing is, people will say to me sometimes, do you keep an idea notebook? And I don't, because I think a notebook is a way to immortalize really terrible ideas. And if you leave them alone, they go away on their own. But the good ones stay, and this one stayed.
Well, at the same time, you began it so long ago, but there's so many things that feel right on the money right now. Under the Dome, we have trapped Big Jim Rennie. He's an evangelical car salesman who hates the feds and hates our president with that terrorist middle name that he's got.
He loves Jesus. Can you give me hallelujah?
Can we get a witness? And you have an Iraqi war veteran who's just haunted by memories of torture. You've got a pimply kid who wants to broadcast this all to the world on the World Wide Web. Does it ever freak you out, Stephen King, that you have such a strange attachment to what people want to hear?
No, I mean, I just tell stories that turn my dials. I like the visual imagery of this, and I had fun because I grew up in a small town, lived in small towns most of my life, feel comfortable there. I sound like a frackin' John Mellencamp song. But, but, you know, one of the things I think I started this, Bush had been in office like 6 years, Bush and Cheney, and I was fascinated by the dynamic of those two men because everybody saw Bush as a kind of puppet on Dick Cheney's lap. Everybody saw Bush as kind of a nice, not bright, but nice guy. And Cheney is this sort of villain, you know, I always think, da, 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 ta-da, Darth Vader kind of thing. So I thought I really would like to put that dynamic to work because the whole thing, the idea of putting a town under the dome, we're all under the dome. We live on a little blue planet that's surrounded by a thin skin of atmosphere. We've got satellites that have gone into outer space beeping away at the universe. We've got the Hubble telescope. And so far as we know, we're the only intelligent life in the area. There may be other intelligent life, but if I were them, I'd steer clear of us. You know, we are the H1N1 of the universe. But what we've got is we've got an exploding population, we've got shrinking resources, we've got an environment that's increasingly foul. And I thought I can put all these things under the dome, and I wanted to use, for my leaders, I kind of wanted to use that Bush-Cheney dynamic, not because I wanted to write a political allegory, God forbid, I just want to write stories, but I loved that sort of sense that I took through the Bush administration, that you could love their policies if you were on the far right, or you could hate their policies if you were on the far left. But the thing nobody seemed to argue about was that they were terribly inept at what they were doing. And I really wanted to use that in the book.
So it is set in Chester's Mill. This is a manufacturing town in Maine. It's one of those little American towns that Sarah Palin might have described as the real America.
Gosh darn it. Yeah. Hockey and, moms.
And people there talk about playing for the team. They sort of consider themselves in a universe unto themselves until they are actually in a universe unto themselves and feel what it's like to be separated. In the book you say, small towns have small imaginations. But what is it about towns like Castle Rock or Chester's Mill that are so fertile for you?
Well, I don't think small towns do have small imaginations. I think that there are people who a lot of times have exaggerated conventions, and as a result, they keep a lot of secrets, but that's fertile ground for a novelist. I write about small towns because it's what I know. I remember reading somewhere in some book on fiction that you can write about a place where you know where the roads go, and that's why I write about Maine as much as I do, because I know where the roads go. I've written about other places. I've written a couple of books that were at least partially set in Colorado, and The Stand, which was friggin' everywhere. So,
Algonquin, Arkansas. You know,
and then there's the Dark Tower books, which are set in Midworld, and that's some of the... It's like, I feel like saying, somebody's going to yell, play Freebird.
In just a moment, we'll hear some of Stephen King's favorite film adaptations of his books and about his recovery from alcohol and drug addiction, and one of his other great passions, the Boston Red Sox. Stay with us for more Stephen King from Writers on a New England Stage in this special edition of Word of Mouth.
Tomorrow.